safe for you here, Potter. He wants you too badly. So go abroad. Go into hiding. Save yourself. Best take these two with you. He jerked a thumb at Ron and Hermione. They'll be in danger long as they live now everyone knows they've been working with you.
I can't leave, said Harry.
I've got a job. Give it to someone else.
I can't. It's got to be me. Dumbledore explained it all.
Oh, did he now? And did he tell you everything? Was he honest with you?
Harry wanted with all his heart to say yes, but somehow the simple word would not rise to his lips. Aberforth seemed to know what he was thinking.
I knew my brother, Potter. He learned secrecy at our mother's knee. Secrets and lies. That's how we grew up. And Albus, he was a natural.
The old man's eyes travelled to the painting of the girl over the mantelpiece. It was, now Harry looked around properly, the only picture in the room. There was no photograph of Albus Dumbledore, nor of anyone else.
Mr. Dumbledore, said Hermione rather timidly. Is that your sister, Ariana?
Yes, said Aberforth tersely. Been reading Rita Skeeter, have you, missy?
Even by the rosy light of the fire, it was clear that Hermione had turned red.
Elpheus Doge mentioned her to us, said Harry, trying to spare Hermione. That old Burke, muttered Aberforth, taking another swig of mead. Thought the sun shone out of my brother's every orifice, he did. Well, so did plenty of people, you three included, by the looks of it.
Harry kept quiet. He did not want to express the doubts and uncertainties about Dumbledore that had riddled him for months now. He had made his choice while he dug Dobby's grave. He had decided to continue along the winding, dangerous path indicated for him by Albus Dumbledore, to accept that he had not been told everything that he wanted to know, but simply to trust. He had no desire to doubt again. He did not want to hear anything that would deflect him from his purpose. He met Aberforth's gaze, which was so strikingly like his brother's. The bright blue eyes gave the same impression that they were X-raying the object of their scrutiny, and Harry thought that Aberforth knew what he was thinking and despised him for it.
Professor Dumbledore cared about Harry very much, said Hermione in a low voice.
Did he now? Said Aberforth. Funny thing, how many of the people my brother cared about very much ended up in a worse state than if he'd left them well alone.
What do you mean?
Asked Hermione breathlessly.
Never you mind, said Aberforth.
But that's a really serious thing to say, said Hermione. Are you talking about your sister?
Aberforth glared at her. His lips moved as if he were chewing the words he was holding back. Then he burst into speech.
When my sister was 6 years old, she was attacked, set upon by 3 muggle boys. They'd seen her doing magic, spying through the back garden hedge. She was a kid. She couldn't control it. No witch or wizard can at that age. What they saw scared them, I expect. They forced their way through the hedge, and when she couldn't show them the trick, they got a bit carried away trying to stop the little freak doing it.
Hermione's eyes were huge in the firelight. Ron looked slightly sick. Aberforth stood up, tall as Albus, and suddenly terrible in his anger and the intensity of his pain.
It destroyed her, what they did. She was never right again. She wouldn't use magic, but she couldn't get rid of it. It turned inward and drove her mad. It exploded out of her when she couldn't control it, and at times she was strange and dangerous. But mostly, she was sweet and scared and harmless. Then my father went after the bastards that did it, said Aberforth, and attacked them, and they locked him up in Azkaban for it. He never said why he'd done it, because if the Ministry had known what Ariana had become, she'd have been locked up in St. Mungo's for good. They'd have seen her as a serious threat to the International Statute of Secrecy, unbalanced like she was, with magic exploding out of her at moments when she couldn't keep it in any longer. We had to keep her safe and quiet. We moved house, put it about she was ill, and my mother looked after her and tried to keep her calm and happy. I was her favorite, he said,
And as he said it, a grubby schoolboy seemed to look out through Aberforth's wrinkles and tangled beard.
Not Albus. He was always up in his bedroom when he was home, reading his books and counting his prizes, keeping up with his correspondence with the most notable magical names of the day.
Aberforth sneered.
He didn't want to be bothered with her. She liked me best. I could get her to eat when she wouldn't do it for my mother. I could get her to calm down when she was in one of her rages, and when she was quiet, she used to help me feed the goats. Then, when she was 14, see, I wasn't there, said Aberforth. If I'd been there, I could have calmed her down. She had one of her rages, and my mother wasn't as young as she was. And it was an accident. Oriana couldn't control it. But my mother was killed.
Harry felt a horrible mixture of pity and repulsion. He did not want to hear any more, but Aberforth kept talking, and Harry wondered how long it had been since he had spoken about this, whether, in fact, he had ever spoken about it.
So that put pay to Albus's trip around the world with little Doge. The pair of them came home from my mother's funeral, and then Doge went off on his own, and Albus settled down as the head of the family. Ha!
Aberforth spat into the fire.
I'd have looked after her. I told him so. I didn't care about school. I'd have stayed home and done it. He told me I had to finish my education, and he'd take over from my mother. Bit of a come-down for Mr. Brilliant. There's no prizes for looking after your half-mad sister, stopping her blowing up the house every other day. But he did all right for a few weeks, till he came.
And now a positively dangerous look crept over Aberforth's face.
Grindelwald. And at last my brother had an equal to talk to. Someone just as bright and talented as he was. And looking after Ariana took a back seat then, while they were hatching all their plans for a new wizarding order and looking for Hallows, and whatever else it was they were so interested in. Grand plans for the benefit of all wizardkind. And if one young girl got neglected, what did that matter when Albus was working for the greater good? But after a few weeks of it, I'd had enough, I had. It was nearly time for me to go back to Hogwarts, so I told them, both of them, face to face, like I am to you now.
And Aberforth looked down at Harry, and it took little imagination to see him as a teenager, wiry and angry, confronting his elder brother.
I told him, you'd better give it up now. You can't move her, she's in no fit state. You can't take her with you, wherever it is you're planning to go, when you're making your clever speeches. "'Trying to whip yourselves up a following?' "'He didn't like that,'
said Aberforth, "'and his eyes were briefly occluded by the firelight on the lenses of his glasses. "'They shone white and blind again.
"'Grindelwald didn't like that at all. "'He got angry. "'He told me what a stupid little boy I was, "'trying to stand in the way of him and my brilliant brother. "'Didn't I understand?' My poor sister wouldn't have to be hidden once they'd changed the world and led the wizards out of hiding and taught the muggles their place. And there was an argument, and I pulled out my wand and he pulled out his, and I had the Cruciatus curse used on me by my brother's best friend, and Albus was trying to stop him, and then all three of us were dueling, and the flashing lights and the bangs set her off. She couldn't stand it.
The colour was draining from Aberforth's face, as though he had suffered a mortal wound.
And I think she wanted to help, but she didn't really know what she was doing, and I don't know which of us did it. It could have been any of us.
And she was dead.
His voice broke on the last word, and he dropped down into the nearest chair. Hermione's face was wet with tears, and Ron was almost as pale as Aberforth. Harry felt nothing but revulsion. He wished he had not heard it, wished he could wash his mind clean of it.
I'm so sorry,
Hermione whispered.
Gone,
croaked Aberforth.
Gone forever.
He wiped his nose on his cuff and cleared his throat.
Course Grindelwald scarpered. He had a bit of a track record already, back in his own country, and he didn't want Ariana set to his account, too. And Albus was free, wasn't he? Free of the burden of his sister. Free to become the greatest wizard of the...
He was never free, said Harry.
I beg your pardon, said Aberforth.
Never, said Harry. The night that your brother died, he drank a potion that drove him out of his mind. He started screaming, pleading with someone who wasn't there. Don't hurt them, please. Hurt me instead. Ron and Hermione were staring at Harry. He had never gone into details about what had happened on the island on the lake. The events that had taken place after he and Dumbledore had returned to Hogwarts had eclipsed it so thoroughly. He thought he was back there with you and Grindelwald.
I know he did,
said Harry, remembering Dumbledore whimpering, pleading. He thought he was watching Grindelwald hurting you and Ariana. It was torture to him. If you'd seen him then, you wouldn't say he was free.
Aberforth seemed lost in contemplation of his own knotted and veined hands. After a long pause, he said,
How can you be sure, Potter, that my brother wasn't more interested in the greater good than in you? How can you be sure you aren't dispensable, just like my little sister?
A shard of ice seemed to pierce Harry's heart.
I don't believe it. Dumbledore loved Harry, said Hermione.
Why didn't he tell him to hide, then? Shot back Aberforth. Why didn't he say to him, Take care of yourself, here's how to survive?
Because, said Harry before Hermione could answer, sometimes you've got to think about more than your own safety. Sometimes you've got to think about the greater good. This is war.
You're 17, boy.
I'm of age, and I'm going to keep fighting even if you've given up.
Who says I've given up?
The Order of the Phoenix is finished, Harry repeated. You know who's won. It's over. And anyone who's pretending difference, kidding themselves.
I don't say I like it, but it's the truth.
No, it isn't, said Harry. Your brother knew how to finish You Know Who, and he passed the knowledge on to me. I'm going to keep going until I succeed, or I die. Don't think I don't know how this might end. I've known it for years.
He waited for Aberforth to jeer or to argue, but he did not. He merely scowled.
We need to get into Hogwarts, said Harry again.
If you can't help us, we'll wait till daybreak, leave you in peace, and try to find a way in ourselves. If you can help us, well, now would be a great time to mention it.
Aberforth remained fixed in his chair, gazing at Harry with the eyes that were so extraordinarily like his brother's. At last he cleared his throat, got to his feet, walked around the little table, and approached the portrait of Ariana.
You know what to do, he said.
She smiled, turned, and walked away. Not as people in portraits usually did, out of the sides of their frames, but along what seemed to be a long tunnel painted behind her. They watched her slight figure retreating, until finally she was swallowed by the darkness.
What?
Began Ron.
There's only one way in now, said Aberforth. You must know they've got all the old secret passageways covered at both ends. Dementors all around the boundary walls, regular patrols inside the school from what my sources tell me. The place has never been so heavily guarded. How you expect to do anything once you get inside it, with Snape in charge and the Carrows as his deputies? Well, that's your lookout, isn't it? You say you're prepared to die.
But what? Said Hermione, frowning at Ariana's picture.
A tiny white dot had reappeared at the end of the painted tunnel, and now Ariana was walking back toward them, growing bigger and bigger as she came. But there was somebody else with her now, someone taller than she was, who was limping along, looking excited. His hair was longer than Harry had ever seen it. He appeared to have suffered several gashes to his face, and his clothes were ripped and torn. Larger and larger the two figures grew, until only their heads and shoulders filled the portrait. Then the whole thing swung forward on the wall like a little door, and the entrance to a real tunnel was revealed. And out of it, his hair overgrown, his face cut, his robes ripped, clambered the real Neville Longbottom, who gave a roar of delight, leapt down from the mantelpiece and yelled,
I knew you'd come! I knew it, Harry!
Chapter 29 The Lost Diadem. Neville, what the... How? But Neville had spotted Ron and Hermione, and with yells of delight was hugging them too. The longer Harry looked at Neville, the worse he appeared. One of his eyes was swollen yellow and purple. There were gouge marks on his face, and his general air of unkemptness suggested that he had been living rough. Nevertheless, his battered visage shone with happiness as he let go of Hermione and said again,
"I knew you'd come. Kept telling Seamus it was a matter of time."
"Neville, what's happened to you?"
"What? This?"
Neville dismissed his injuries with a shake of the head.
"This is nothing. Seamus is worse. You'll see. Shall we get going, then?"
"Oh." He turned to Aberforth.
"Ab, there might be a couple more people on the way."
"Couple more?" repeated Aberforth ominously. "What do you mean, a couple more, Longbottom? There's a curfew and a caterwauling charm on the whole village."
"I know. That's why they'll be apparating directly into the bar," said Neville. "Just send them down the passage when they get here, will you? Thanks a lot."
Neville held out his hand to Hermione and helped her to climb up onto the mantelpiece and into the tunnel. Ron followed, then Neville. Harry addressed Aberforth. "I don't know how to thank you. You've saved our lives twice."
"Look after 'em, then," said Aberforth gruffly. "I might not be able to save 'em a third time."
Harry clambered up onto the mantelpiece and through the hole behind Ariana's portrait. There were smooth stone steps on the other side. It looked as though the passageway had been there for years. Brass lamps hung from the walls, and the earthy floor was worn and smooth. As they walked, their shadows rippled, fan-like, across the wall.
"How long has this been here?" Ron asked as they set off. "It isn't on the Marauder's map, is it, Harry? I thought there were only 7 passages in and out of school."
"They sealed off all of those before the start of the year," said Neville. "There's no chance of getting through any of them now. Not with curses over the entrances and Death Eaters and Dementors waiting at the exits."
He started walking backward, beaming, drinking them in.
"Never mind that stuff. Is it true? Did you break into Gringotts? Did you escape on a dragon? It's everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. Terry Boot got beaten up by Caro for yelling about it in the Great Hall at dinner."
"Yeah, it's true," said Harry.
Neville laughed gleefully.
"What did you do with the dragon?"
"Released it into the wild," said Ron.
"Hermione was all for keeping it as a pet."
"Don't exaggerate, Ron."
"But what have you been doing? People have been saying you've just been on the run, Harry. But I don't think so. I think you've been up to something."
"You're right," said Harry.
"But tell us about Hogwarts, Neville. We haven't heard anything."
"It's been... well, it's not really like Hogwarts anymore," said Neville, the smile fading from his face as he spoke.
"Do you know about the Carrows?
Those 2 Death Eaters who teach here?"
"They do more than teach," said Neville. "They're in charge of all discipline. They like punishment, the Carrows."
"Like Umbridge?"
"Nah, they make her look tame.
The other teachers are all supposed to refer us to the Carrows if we do anything wrong. They don't, though, if they can avoid it. You can tell they all hate them as much as we do. Amicus, the bloke, he teaches what used to be defense against the dark arts. Except now, it's just the dark arts. We're supposed to practice the Cruciatus curse on people who've earned detentions."
"What?"
Harry, Ron, and Hermione's united voices echoed up and down the passage.
"Yeah," said Neville. "That's how I got this one."
He pointed at a particularly deep gash in his cheek.
"I refuse to do it. Some people are into it, though. Crabbe and Goyle love it. First time they've ever been top in anything, I expect. Alecto, Amicus's sister, teaches Muggle studies, which is compulsory for everyone. We've all got to listen to her explain how Muggles are like animals, stupid and dirty, and how they drove wizards into hiding by being vicious toward them, and how the natural order is being re-established. I got this one," he indicated another slash to his face, "for asking her how much Muggle blood she and her brother have got."
"Blimey, Neville," said Ron. "There's a time and a place for getting a smart mouth."
"You didn't hear her," said Neville. "You wouldn't have stood it either. The thing is, it helps when people stand up to them. It gives everyone hope. I used to notice that when you did it, Harry." "But they've used you as a knife sharpener," said Ron, wincing slightly as they passed a lamp,
and Neville's injuries were thrown into even greater relief. Neville shrugged. Doesn't matter. They don't want to spill too much pure blood, so they'll torture us a bit if we're mouthy, but they won't actually kill us. Harry did not know what was worse, the things that Neville was saying, or the matter-of-fact tone in which he said them. The only people in real danger are the ones whose friends and relatives on the outside are giving trouble. They get taken hostage. Old Zeno Lovegood was getting a bit too outspoken in the Quibbler, so they dragged Luna off the train on the way back for Christmas. Neville, she's all right. We've seen her.
Yeah, I know. She managed to get a message to me.
From his pocket he pulled a golden coin, and Harry recognized it as one of the fake galleons that Dumbledore's army had used to send one another messages.
These have been great, said Neville, beaming at Hermione.
The Carrows never rumbled how we were communicating. It drove them mad. We used to sneak out at night and put graffiti on the walls. Dumbledore's army, still recruiting. Stuff like that. Snape hated it.
You used to? Said Harry, who had noticed the past tense.
Well, it got more difficult as time went on, said Neville. We lost Luna at Christmas, and Ginny never came back after Easter, and the three of us were sort of the leaders. The Carrows seemed to know I was behind a lot of it, so they started coming down on me hard. And then Michael Corner went and got caught releasing a first year they'd chained up, and they tortured him pretty badly. That scared people off.
No kidding, muttered Ron, as the passage began to slope upward.
Yeah, well, I couldn't ask people to go through what Michael did, so we dropped those kinds of stunts. But we were still fighting, doing underground stuff, right up until a couple of weeks ago. That's when they decided there was only one way to stop me, I suppose. And they went for Gran.
They what? Said Harry, Ron and Hermione together.
Yeah,
said Neville, panting a little now, because the passage was climbing so steeply.
Well, you can see their thinking. It had worked really well, kidnapping kids to force their relatives to behave. I suppose it was only a matter of time before they did it the other way around. Thing was,
he faced them, and Harry was astonished to see that he was grinning.
They bit up a bit more than they could chew with Gran. Little old witch living alone. They probably thought they didn't need to send anyone particularly powerful. Anyway,
Neville laughed.
Dawlish is still in St. Mungo's, and Gran's on the run. She sent me a letter.
He clapped a hand to the breast pocket of his robes,
telling me she was proud of me, that I'm my parents' son, and to keep it up.
Cool, said Ron.
Yeah, said Neville happily. Only thing was,
once they realized they had no hold over me, they decided Hogwarts could do without me after all. I don't know whether they were planning to kill me or send me to Azkaban. Either way, I knew it was time to disappear.
But, said Ron, looking thoroughly confused, aren't we heading straight back into Hogwarts?
Course, said Neville.
You'll see. We're here.
They turned a corner, and there ahead of them was the end of the passage. Another short flight of steps led to a door, just like the one hidden behind Ariana's portrait. Neville pushed it open and climbed through. As Harry followed, he heard Neville call out to unseen people.
Look who it is! Didn't I tell you?
As Harry emerged into the room beyond the passage, there were several screams and yells.
Harry!
It's Potter! It's Potter!
Ron!
Hermione!
He had a confused impression of coloured hangings, of lamps, and many faces. The next moment he, Ron, and Hermione were engulfed, hugged, pounded on the back, their hair ruffled, their hands shaken by what seemed to be more than 20 people. They might just have won a Quidditch final.
Okay, okay, calm down, Neville called.
And as the crowd backed away, Harry was able to take in their surroundings. He did not recognize the room at all. It was enormous, and looked rather like the interior of a particularly sumptuous treehouse, or perhaps a gigantic ship's cabin. Multicolored hammocks were strung from the ceiling and from a balcony that ran around the dark wood-paneled and windowless walls, which were covered in bright tapestry hangings. Harry saw the gold Gryffindor lion, emblazoned on scarlet, the black badger of Hufflepuff, set against yellow, and the bronze eagle of Ravenclaw on blue. The silver and green of Slytherin alone were absent. There were bulging bookcases, a few broomsticks propped against the walls, and in the corner, a large wooden-cased wireless.
Where are we? Room of requirement, of course, said Neville. Surpassed itself, hasn't it? The Carrows were chasing me, and I knew I had just one chance for a hideout. I managed to get through the door, and this is what I found. Well, it wasn't exactly like this when I arrived. There was a load smaller. There was only one hammock and just Gryffindor hangings. But it's expanded as more and more of the DA have arrived.
And the Carrows can't get in? Asked Harry, looking around for the door.
No,
said Seamus Finnegan, whom Harry had not recognized until he spoke. Seamus's face was bruised and puffy.
It's a proper hideout. As long as one of us stays in here, they can't get at us. The door won't open. It's all down to Neville. He really gets this room. You've got to ask it for exactly what you need, like, I don't want any Carroll supporters to be able to get in, and it'll do it for you. You've just got to make sure you close the loopholes. Neville's the man.
It's quite straightforward, really, said Neville modestly. I'd been in here about a day and a half and getting really hungry and wishing I could get something to eat, and that's when the passage to the Hogshead opened up. I went through it and met Aberforth. He's been providing us with food, because for some reason, that's the one thing the room doesn't really do.
Yeah, well, food's one of the 5 exceptions to Gamp's law of elemental transfiguration, said Ron to general astonishment. So we've been hiding out here for nearly 2 weeks, said Seamus, and it just makes more hammocks every time we need them. And it even sprouted a pretty good bathroom once girls started turning up.
And thought they'd quite like to wash, yes,
supplied Lavender Brown, whom Harry had not noticed until that point. Now that he looked around properly, he recognized many familiar faces. Both Patil twins were there, as were Terry Boot, Ernie McMillan, Anthony Goldstein, and Michael Corner.
Tell us what you've been up to, though, said Ernie. There've been so many rumors. We've been trying to keep up with you on Potter Watch.
He pointed at the wireless.
You didn't break into Gringotts.
They did, said Neville. And the dragon's true, too.
There was a smattering of applause and a few whoops. Ron took a bow.
What were you after? Asked Seamus eagerly.
Before any of them could parry the question with one of their own, Harry felt a terrible, scorching pain in the lightning scar. As he turned his back hastily on the curious and delighted faces, the room of requirement vanished, and he was standing inside a ruined stone shack, and the rotting floorboards were ripped apart at his feet. A disinterred golden box lay open and empty beside the hole, and Voldemort's scream of fury vibrated inside his head. With an enormous effort, he pulled out of Voldemort's mind again, back to where he stood, swaying, in the room of requirement, sweat pouring from his face, and Ron holding him up.
"Are you all right, Harry?" Neville was saying. "Want to sit down? I expect you're tired, aren't—"
"No," said Harry.
He looked at Ron and Hermione, trying to tell them without words that Voldemort had just discovered the loss of one of the other Horcruxes. Time was running out fast. If Voldemort chose to visit Hogwarts next, they would miss their chance.
"We need to get going," he said,
and their expressions told him that they understood.
"What are we going to do then, Harry?" asked Seamus. "What's the plan?"
"Plan?"
repeated Harry. He was exercising all his willpower to prevent himself succumbing again to Voldemort's rage. His scar was still burning.
"Well, there's something we, Ron, Hermione and I, need to do, and then we'll get out of here."
Nobody was laughing or whooping any more. Neville looked confused.
"What do you mean, get out of here?"
"We haven't come back to stay," said Harry, rubbing his scar, trying to soothe the pain. "There's something important we need to do."
"What is it?"
I can't tell you."
There was a ripple of muttering at this. Neville's brows contracted.
"Why can't you tell us? It's something to do with fighting you-know-who, right?"
"Well, yeah."
"Then we'll help you."
The other members of Dumbledore's army were nodding, some enthusiastically, others solemnly. A couple of them rose from their chairs to demonstrate their willingness for immediate action.
"You don't understand."
Harry seemed to have said that a lot in the last few hours.
We can't tell you. We've got to do it alone."
"Why?" asked Neville.
"Because," in his desperation to start looking for the missing Horcrux, or at least to have a private discussion with Ron and Hermione about where they might commence their search, Harry found it difficult to gather his thoughts. His scar was still searing.
Dumbledore left the three of us a job, he said carefully, and we weren't supposed to tell. I mean, he wanted us to do it, just the three of us.
We're his army, said Neville.
Dumbledore's army! We were all in it together. We've been keeping it going while you three have been off on your own.
It hasn't exactly been a picnic, mate, said Ron.
I never said it had, but I don't see why you can't trust us. Everyone in this room's been fighting, and they've been driven in here because the Carrows were hunting them down. Everyone in here's proven they're loyal to Dumbledore, loyal to you.
Look, Harry began, without knowing what he was going to say, but it did not matter. The tunnel door had just opened behind him.
We got your message, Neville. Hello, you three. I thought you must be here.
It was Luna and Dean. Seamus gave a great roar of delight and ran to hug his best friend.
Hi, everyone, said Luna happily. Oh, it's great to be back.
Luna, said Harry distractedly, what are you doing here? How did you...
I sent for her, said Neville, holding up the fake galleon. I promised her and Ginny that if you turned up, I'd let them know. We all thought that if you came back, it would mean revolution, that we were going to overthrow Snape and the Carrows.
Of course that's what it means, said Luna brightly.
Isn't it, Harry? We're going to fight them out of Hogwarts.
Listen, said Harry with a rising sense of panic. I'm sorry, but that's not what we came back for. There's something we've got to do, and then...
You're going to leave us in this mess?
Demanded Michael Corner.
No,
said Ron.
What we're doing will benefit everyone in the end. It's all about trying to get rid of you-know-who.
Then let us help,
said Neville angrily.
We want to be a part of it.
There was another noise behind them, and Harry turned. His heart seemed to fail. Ginny was now climbing through the hole in the wall, closely followed by Fred, George, and Lee Jordan. Ginny gave Harry a radiant smile. He had forgotten, or had never fully appreciated, how beautiful she was. But he had never been less pleased to see her.
Aberforth's getting a bit annoyed,
said Fred, raising his hand in answer to several cries of greeting.
He wants a kip, and his bar's turned into a railway station.
Harry's mouth fell open. Right behind Lee Jordan came Harry's old girlfriend, Cho Chang. She smiled at him.
I got the message,
she said, holding up her own fake galleon, and she walked over to sit beside Michael Corner.
So what's the plan, Harry? Said George.
There isn't one, said Harry, still disoriented by the sudden appearance of all these people, unable to take everything in while his scar was still burning so fiercely.
Just going to make it up as we go along, are we?
My favorite kind, said Fred.
You've got to stop this, Harry told Neville.
What did you call them all back for? This is insane.
We're fighting, aren't we?
Said Dean, taking out his fake galleon.
The message said Harry was back, and we were going to fight. I'll have to get a wand, though.
You haven't got a wand?
Began Seamus. Ron turned suddenly to Harry.
Why can't they help?
What?
They can help.
He dropped his voice and said, so that none of them could hear but Hermione, who stood between them,
We don't know where it is. We've got to find it fast. We don't have to tell them it's a Horcrux.
Harry looked from Ron to Hermione, who murmured,
I think Ron's right. We don't even know what we're looking for. We need them.
And when Harry looked unconvinced,
You don't have to do everything alone, Harry.
Harry thought fast, his scar still prickling, his head threatening to split again. Dumbledore had warned him against telling anyone but Ron and Hermione about the Horcruxes.
Secrets and lies. That's how we grew up. And Albus, he was a natural.
Was he turning into Dumbledore, keeping his secrets clutched to his chest, afraid to trust? But Dumbledore had trusted Snape. And where had that led? To murder at the top of the highest tower. All right, he said quietly to the other two.
Okay,
he called to the room at large. And all noise ceased. Fred and George, who had been cracking jokes for the benefit of those nearest, fell silent, and all of them looked alert, excited.
There's something we need to find, Harry said. Something. Something that'll help us overthrow you-know-who. It's here, at Hogwarts, but we don't know where. It might have belonged to Ravenclaw. Has anyone heard of an object like that? Has anyone ever come across something with her eagle on it?
for instance? He looked hopefully toward the little group of Ravenclaws, to Padma, Michael, Terry, and Cho, but it was Luna who answered, perched on the arm of Ginny's chair.
Well, there's her lost diadem. I told you about it, remember, Harry? The lost diadem of Ravenclaw. Daddy's trying to duplicate it.
Yeah, but the lost diadem, said Michael Corner, rolling his eyes, is lost, Luna. That's sort of the point.
When was it lost? Asked Harry.
Centuries ago, they say, said Cho,
and Harry's heart sank.
Professor Flitwick says the diadem vanished with Ravenclaw herself. People have looked, but...
She appealed to her fellow Ravenclaws.
Nobody's ever found a trace of it, have they?
They all shook their heads.
Sorry, but what is a diadem? Asked Ron.
It's a kind of crown, said Terry Boot.
Ravenclaws were supposed to have magical properties, enhance the wisdom of the wearer.
Yes, Daddy's Rexpert siphons.
But Harry cut across Luna. And none of you have ever seen anything that looks like it? They all shook their heads again. Harry looked at Ron and Hermione, and his own disappointment was mirrored back at him. An object that had been lost this long, and apparently without trace, did not seem like a good candidate for the Horcrux hidden in the castle. Before he could formulate a new question, however, Cho spoke again.
If you'd like to see what the diadem's supposed to look like, I could take you up to our common room and show you, Harry. Ravenclaw's wearing it in her statue.
Harry's scar scorched again. For a moment the room of requirements swam before him, and he saw instead the dark earth soaring beneath him, and felt the great snake wrapped around his shoulders. Voldemort was flying again, whether to the underground lake or here, to the castle, he did not know. Either way, there was hardly any time left.
"He's on the move," he said quietly to Ron and Hermione. He glanced at Cho and then back at them. "Listen, I know it's not much of a lead, but I'm going to go and look at this statue, at least find out what the diadem looks like. Wait for me here and keep, you know, the other one safe."
Cho had got to her feet, but Ginny said rather fiercely,
"No, Luna will take Harry, won't you, Luna?"
"Oh, yes, I'd like to,"
said Luna happily, and Cho sat down again, looking disappointed. "How do we get out?" Harry asked Neville.
"Over here."
He led Harry and Luna to a corner where a small cupboard opened onto a steep staircase.
"It comes out somewhere different every day, so they've never been able to find it," he said. "Only trouble is, we never know exactly where we're going to end up when we go out. Be careful, Harry. They're always patrolling the corridors at night."
"No problem," said Harry. "See you in a bit." He and Luna hurried up the staircase, which was long, lit by torches, and turned corners in unexpected places. At last they reached what appeared to be solid wall.
"Get under here," Harry told Luna, pulling out the invisibility cloak and throwing it over both of them.
He gave the wall a little push. It melted away at his touch, and they slipped outside. Harry glanced back and saw that it had resealed itself at once. They were standing in a dark corridor. Harry pulled Luna back into the shadows, fumbled in the pouch around his neck, and took out the Marauder's map. Holding it close to his nose, he searched and located his and Luna's dots at last.
"We're up on the fifth floor," he whispered, watching Filch moving away from them, a corridor ahead. "Come on, this way."
They crept off. Harry had prowled the castle at night many times before, but never had his heart hammered this fast. Never had so much depended on his safe passage through the place. Through squares of moonlight upon the floor, past suits of armor whose helmets creaked at the sound of their soft footsteps, around corners beyond which who knew what lurked, Harry and Luna walked, checking the Marauder's map whenever light permitted, twice pausing to allow a ghost to pass without drawing attention to themselves. He expected to encounter an obstacle at any moment. His worst fear was Peeves. And he strained his ears with every step to hear the first telltale signs of the poltergeist's approach.
"This way, Harry,"
breathed Luna, plucking his sleeve and pulling him toward a spiral staircase. They climbed in tight, dizzying circles. Harry had never been up here before. At last they reached the door. There was no handle and no keyhole, nothing but a plain expanse of aged wood, and a bronze knocker in the shape of an eagle. Luna reached out a pale hand which looked eerie floating in midair, unconnected to arm or body. She knocked once, and in the silence it sounded to Harry like a cannon blast. At once the beak of the eagle opened, but instead of a bird's call, a soft, musical voice said,
"Which came first, the phoenix or the flame?"
What do you think, Harry? Said Luna, looking thoughtful.
What? Isn't there just a password?
Oh, no. You've got to answer a question, said Luna.
What if you get it wrong?
Well, you have to wait for somebody who gets it right, said Luna. That way you learn, you see?
Yeah. Trouble is, we can't really afford to wait for anyone else, Luna.
No, I see what you mean, said Luna seriously. Well, then, I think the answer is that a circle has no beginning.
Well reasoned, said the voice,
and the door swung open. The deserted Ravenclaw common room was a wide, circular room, airier than any Harry had ever seen at Hogwarts. Graceful arched windows punctuated the walls, which were hung with blue and bronze silks. By day, the Ravenclaws would have a spectacular view of the surrounding mountains. The ceiling was domed and painted with stars, which were echoed in the midnight blue carpet. There were tables, chairs, and bookcases, and in a niche opposite the door stood a tall statue of white marble. Harry recognized Rowena Ravenclaw from the bust he had seen at Luna's house. The statue stood beside a door that led, he guessed, to dormitories above. He strode right up to the marble woman, and she seemed to look back at him with a quizzical half-smile on her face. Beautiful, yet slightly intimidating. A delicate-looking circlet had been reproduced in marble on top of her head. It was not unlike the tiara Fleur had worn at her wedding. There were tiny words etched into it. Harry stepped out from under the cloak and climbed up onto Ravenclaw's plinth to read them. "Wit beyond measure is man's greatest treasure."
"Which makes you pretty skint, witless," said a cackling voice.
Harry whirled around, slipped off the plinth, and landed on the floor. The sloping-shouldered figure of Alecto Caro was standing before him, and even as Harry raised his wand, she pressed a stubby forefinger to the skull and snake branded on her forearm. Chapter 30. The Sacking of Severus Snape. The moment her finger touched the mark, Harry's scar burned savagely. The starry room vanished from sight, and he was standing upon an outcrop of rock beneath a cliff, and the sea was washing around him, and there was triumph in his heart.
"They have the boy!"
A loud bang brought Harry back to where he stood. Disoriented, he raised his wand, but the witch before him was already falling forward. She hit the ground so hard that the glass in the bookcases tinkled.
"I've never stunned anyone except in our DA lessons," said Luna, sounding mildly interested. "That was noisier than I thought it would be."
And sure enough, the ceiling had begun to tremble. Scurrying, echoing footsteps were growing louder from behind the door leading to the dormitories. Luna's spell had woken Ravenclaws sleeping above.
"Luna, where are you? I need to get under the cloak."
Luna's feet appeared out of nowhere. He hurried to her side, and she let the cloak fall back over them as the door opened and a stream of Ravenclaws, all in their night clothes, flooded into the common room. There were gasps and cries of surprise as they saw Alecto lying there unconscious. Slowly they shuffled in around her, a savage beast that might wake at any moment and attack them. Then one brave little first year darted up to her and prodded her backside with his big toe.
"I think she might be dead,"
he shouted with delight.
"Oh, look,"
whispered Luna happily, as the Ravenclaws crowded in around Alecto.
"They're pleased."
"Yeah, great."
Harry closed his eyes, and as his scar throbbed, he chose to sink again into Voldemort's mind. He was moving along the tunnel into the first cave. He had chosen to make sure of the locket before coming, but that would not take him long. There was a rap on the common room door, and every Ravenclaw froze. From the other side, Harry heard the soft, musical voice that issued from the eagle door knocker.
"Where do vanished objects go?"
"I don't know, do I? Shut it!"
snarled an uncouth voice that Harry knew was that of the Caro brother, Amicus.
"Alecto! Alecto! Are you there? Have you got him?"
Open the door!
The Ravenclaws were whispering among themselves, terrified. Then, without warning, there came a series of loud bangs as though somebody was firing a gun into the door.
Alexo! If he comes, and we haven't got Potter, do you want to go the same way as the Malfoys? Answer me!
Amicus bellowed, shaking the door for all he was worth, but still it did not open. The Ravenclaws were all backing away, and some of the most frightened began scampering back up the staircase to their beds. Then, just as Harry was wondering whether he ought not to blast open the door and stun Amicus before the Death Eater could do anything else, a second, most familiar voice rang out beyond the door.
May I ask what you are doing, Professor Carrow?
Trying to get through this damned door, shouted Amicus. Go and get Flitwick. Get him to open it, now.
But isn't your sister in there? Asked Professor McGonagall. Didn't Professor Flitwick let her in earlier this evening at your urgent request? Perhaps she could open the door for you. Then you needn't wake up half the castle.
She ain't answering you, old Beezen. You open it, go on. Do it, now.
Certainly, if you wish it,
said Professor McGonagall with awful coldness. There was a genteel tap of the knocker, and the musical voice asked again.
Where do vanished objects go?
Into non-being, which is to say everything, replied Professor McGonagall.
Nicely phrased,
replied the eagle door knocker, and the door swung open. The few Ravenclaws who had remained behind sprinted for the stairs as Amicus burst over the threshold, brandishing his wand. Hunched like his sister, he had a pallid, doughy face and tiny eyes, which fell at once on Alecto, sprawled motionless on the floor. He let out a yell of fury and fear.
What have they done? The little whelps! He screamed. I'll crucifix the lot of them till they tell me who did it! And what's the Dark Lord going to say?
He shrieked, standing over his sister and smacking himself on the forehead with his fist.
We haven't got him, and they've gone and killed her.
She's only stunned,
said Professor McGonagall impatiently, who had stooped down to examine Alecto.
She'll be perfectly all right.
No, she bludgering well won't, bellowed Amicus. Not after the Dark Lord gets hold of her. She's gone and sent for him. I felt me mark burn, and he thinks we've got Potter.
Got Potter? Said Professor McGonagall sharply. What do you mean, got Potter?
He told us Potter might try and get inside Ravenclaw Tower, and to send for him if we caught him.
Why would Harry Potter try to get inside Ravenclaw Tower? Potter belongs in my house.
Beneath the disbelief and anger, Harry heard a little strain of pride in her voice, and affection for Minerva McGonagall gushed up inside him.
We was told he might come in here, said Carrow. I don't know why, do I?
Professor McGonagall stood up, and her beady eyes swept the room. Twice they passed right over the place where Harry and Luna stood.
We can push it off on the kids,
said Amicus, his pig-like face suddenly crafty.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. We'll say Alecto was ambushed by the kids. Them kids, up there.
He looked up at the starry ceiling toward the dormitories.
And we'll say they forced her to press her mark. And that's why he got a false alarm. He can punish them. Couple of kids, more or less. What's the difference?
Only the difference between truth and lies, courage and cowardice, said Professor McGonagall, who had turned pale. A difference, in short, which you and your sister seem unable to appreciate. But let me make one thing very clear. You are not going to pass off your many ineptitudes on the students of Hogwarts. I shall not permit it.
Excuse me?
Amicus moved forward until he was offensively close to Professor McGonagall, his face within inches of hers. She refused to back away, but looked down at him as if he were something disgusting she had found stuck to a lavatory seat.
It's not a case of what you'll permit, Minerva McGonagall. Your time's over. It's us what's in charge here now, and you'll back me up or you'll pay the price.
And he spat in her face. Harry pulled the cloak off himself, raised his wand and said,
You shouldn't have done that.
As Amicus spun around, Harry shouted,
Crucio!
The Death Eater was lifted off his feet. He writhed through the air like a drowning man, thrashing and howling in pain, and then with a crunch and a shattering of glass, He smashed into the front of a bookcase and crumpled, insensible, to the floor.
I see what Bellatrix meant, said Harry, the blood thundering through his brain. You need to really mean it.
Potter,
whispered Professor McGonagall, clutching her heart.
Potter, you're here. What? How?
She struggled to pull herself together.
Potter, that was foolish.
He spat at you, said Harry.
Potter, that was very, very gallant of you. But don't you realize?
Yeah, I do,
Harry assured her. Somehow, her panic steadied him. Professor McGonagall, Voldemort's on the way.
Oh, are we allowed to say the name now?
Asked Luna, with an air of interest, pulling off the invisibility cloak. This appearance of a second outlaw seemed to overwhelm Professor McGonagall, who staggered backward and fell into a nearby chair, clutching at the neck of her old tartan dressing gown. I don't think it makes any difference what we call him, Harry told Luna. He already knows where I am. In a distant part of Harry's brain, that part connected to the angry burning scar, he could see Voldemort sailing fast over the dark lake in the ghostly green boat. He had nearly reached the island where the stone basin stood.
You must flee, whispered Professor McGonagall.
Now, Potter, as quickly as you can.
I can't, said Harry. There's something I need to do. Professor, do you know where the Diadem of Ravenclaw is?
The Diadem of Ravenclaw? Of course not. Hasn't it been lost for centuries?
She sat up a little straighter.
Potter, it was madness, utter madness for you to enter this castle.
I had to, said Harry. Professor, there's something hidden here that I'm supposed to find, and it could be the Diadem. If I could just speak to Professor Flitwick. There was a sound of movement, of clinking glass. Amicus was coming round. Before Harry or Luna could act, Professor McGonagall rose to her feet, pointed her wand at the groggy Death Eater, and said,
Imperial!
Amicus got up, walked over to his sister, picked up her wand, then shuffled obediently to Professor McGonagall and handed it over along with his own. Then he lay down on the floor beside Electo. Professor McGonagall waved her wand again, and a length of shimmering silver rope appeared out of thin air and snaked around the carrows, binding them tightly together.
Potter,
said Professor McGonagall, turning to face him again with superb indifference to the carrow's predicament.
If he who must not be named does indeed know that you are here.
As she said it, a wrath that was like physical pain blazed through Harry, setting his scar on fire. And for a second he looked down upon a basin whose potion had turned clear, and saw that no golden locket lay safe beneath the surface.
Potter, are you all right?
Said a voice, and Harry came back. He was clutching Luna's shoulder to steady himself.
Time's running out. Voldemort's getting nearer. Professor, I'm acting on Dumbledore's orders. I must find what he wanted me to find. But we've got to get the students out while I'm searching the castle. It's me Voldemort wants. But he won't care about killing a few more or less.
Not now. Not now he knows I'm attacking Horcruxes. Harry finished the sentence in his head.
You're acting on Dumbledore's orders?
She repeated with a look of dawning wonder. Then she drew herself up to her fullest height.
We shall secure the school against he who must not be named while you search for this object.
Is that possible?
I think so, said Professor McGonagall dryly. We teachers are rather good at magic, you know. I am sure we will be able to hold him up for a while, if we all put our best efforts into it. Of course, something will have to be done about Professor Snape.
Let me...
And if Hogwarts is about to enter a state of siege, with the Dark Lord at the gates, it would indeed be advisable to take as many innocent people out of the way as possible. With the flu network under observation, and apparition impossible within the grounds...
There's a way, said Harry quickly, and he explained about the passageway leading into the Hogshead.
Potter! We're talking about hundreds of students!
I know, Professor, but if Voldemort and the Death Eaters are concentrating on the school boundaries, they won't be interested in anyone who's disapparating out of the Hogshead.
There's something in that, she agreed.
She pointed her wand at the carrows, and a silver net fell upon their bound bodies, tied itself around them, and hoisted them into the air, where they dangled beneath the blue and gold ceiling like two large, ugly sea creatures.
Come, we must alert the other heads of house.
You'd better put that cloak back on. She marched toward the door, and as she did so she raised her wand. From the tip burst three silver cats with spectacle markings around their eyes. The Patronuses ran sleekly ahead, filling the spiral staircase with silvery light, as Professor McGonagall, Harry, and Luna hurried back down. Along the corridors they raced, and one by one the Patronuses left them. Professor McGonagall's tartan dressing gown rustled over the floor, and Harry and Luna jogged behind her under the cloak. They had descended two more floors when another set of quiet footsteps joined theirs. Harry, whose scar was still prickling, heard them first. He felt in the pouch around his neck for the Marauder's map, but before he could take it out, McGonagall too seemed to become aware of their company. She halted, raised her wand ready to duel, and said,
"Who's there?"
"It is I," said a low voice. From behind a suit of armor stepped Severus Snape. Hatred boiled up in Harry at the sight of him. He had forgotten the details of Snape's appearance in the magnitude of his crimes, forgotten how his greasy black hair hung in curtains around his thin face, how his black eyes had a dead, cold look. He was not wearing night clothes, but was dressed in his usual black cloak, and he too was holding his wand, ready for a fight. "Where are the Carrows?" he asked quietly.
"Wherever you told them to be, I expect, Severus," said Professor McGonagall.
Snape stepped nearer, and his eyes flitted over Professor McGonagall into the air around her, as if he knew that Harry was there. Harry held his wand up too, ready to attack.
"I was under the impression," Snape said, "that Electo had apprehended an intruder."
"Really?" said Professor McGonagall. "And what gave you that impression?"
Snape made a slight flexing movement of his left arm where the dark mark was branded into his skin.
"Oh, but naturally," said Professor McGonagall. "You Death Eaters have your own private means of communication. I forgot."
Snape pretended not to have heard her. His eyes were still probing the air all about her, and he was moving gradually closer, with an air of hardly noticing what he was doing.
"I did not know that it was your night to patrol the corridors, Minerva. You have some objection? I wonder what could have brought you out of your bed at this late hour."
"I thought I heard a disturbance," said Professor McGonagall.
"Really? But all seems calm."
Snape looked into her eyes.
"Have you seen Harry Potter, Minerva? Because if you have, I must insist."
Professor McGonagall moved faster than Harry could have believed. Her wand slashed through the air, and for a split second, Harry thought that Snape must crumple, unconscious. But the swiftness of his shield charm was such that McGonagall was thrown off balance. She brandished her wand at a torch on the wall, and it flew out of its bracket. Harry, about to curse Snape, was forced to pull Luna out of the way of the descending flames, which became a ring of fire that filled the corridor and flew like a lasso at Snape. Then it was no longer fire, but a great black serpent that McGonagall blasted to smoke, which reformed and solidified in seconds to become a swarm of pursuing daggers. Snape avoided them only by forcing the suit of armor in front of him, and with echoing clangs, the daggers sank one after another into its breast.
"Minerva!"
said a squeaky voice, and looking behind him, still shielding Luna from flying spells, Harry saw Professors Flitwick and Sprout sprinting up the corridor toward them in their nightclothes, with the enormous Professor Slughorn panting along at the rear.
"No!"
squealed Flitwick, raising his wand.
"You'll do no more murder at Hogwarts!"
Flitwick's spell hit the suit of armor behind which Snape had taken shelter. With a clatter, it came to life. Snape struggled free of the crushing arms and sent it flying back toward his attackers. Harry and Luna had to dive sideways to avoid it as it smashed into the wall and shattered. When Harry looked up again, Snape was in full flight, McGonagall, Flitwick, and Sprout all thundering after him. He hurtled through a classroom door and, moments later, he heard McGonagall cry,
"Coward! Coward!"
"What's happened? What's happened?" asked Luna.
Harry dragged her to her feet, and they raced along the corridor, trailing the invisibility cloak behind them, into the deserted classroom where Professors McGonagall, Flitwick, and Sprout were standing at a smashed window.
"He jumped," said Professor McGonagall, as Harry and Luna ran into the room.
"Do you mean he's dead?" Harry sprinted.